Already?
Yeah. Okay. Call the meeting to order. It's 8:19. We aren't going to take any, we don't have a quorum yet, but we aren't going to take any votes for a while. We have the omnibus walkthrough first, and we have kind of a minimalistic target with expectations that are tough to meet, so there were some creative things that were done just to be able to move this out. The first article is going to be the spreadsheet portions. The veterans article will be moving separately as Representative Severson and Senator Vickerman's bill. So we will have veterans articles without veterans appropriations in this particular bill. If we need to bring it in ways and means are on the floor, we certainly can do that. But in conference, as long as one or the other passes the floor, it can be brought in conference. So we'll start with Ms. Roberts, and then we'll move over to Mr. Shepherd for the GovOps veterans article and Ms. McKnight for the elections articles. Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, members, for Article 1, I'm actually going to be walking through the spreadsheet, which should be out for the public also by now, instead of walking through the language of Article 1. This bill has, in the fiscal year 2006-2007 biennium, a net general fund impact of zero. The new expenditures within the bill are balanced out by some revenue changes. The first item that is funded through this bill is $10,000 to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for a legislative forum for the purposes of Minnesota legislators meeting with counterparts from the Dakotas and Canada. The second item is a reallocation of funding for public broadcasting. $190,000 each year is moved from Minnesota Public Radio to public television matching grants, and this additional funding for public television is specified as one time. The third item is $1.7 million for the Office of Enterprise Technology's request for Enterprise Information Technology Security Management. And again, this is specified as one-time money. The next item is for the Department of Finance. Again, this is a governor's request for bankruptcy counsel for the Northwest Airlines proceedings, and that's $325,000. I believe it should be one-time money, although the language in the bill doesn't specify that. We may want to clarify that. And the bill also specifies that the appropriation is available until expended. And finally, on the expenditure change side, there is a change to the State Board of Investment. This is a request they made in the last session. It was not did not finally make it through the session, but they've asked for it again to change the way that their funding is structured. Currently, they're funded through a direct general fund appropriation. They bill the pension plans for their expenses, and those receipts are deposited in the general fund as non-dedicated receipts. This change would allow the State Board of Investment to directly bill the plans and keep those receipts, in effect moving them into a special revenue fund kind of arrangement. So that those spending items all total, between the new spending, the reallocations, and the elimination of the direct general fund for the State Board of Investment to $50,000. These are offset by, again, you'll just see the State Board of Investment. This is the corresponding revenue reduction for the general fund. And then $2 million in additional sale of surplus state lands. And you'll, I think, recall, members, that this has been done before in the state government finance bill. And it is backed up if the executive branch is not able to sell this amount of surplus state land. It's backed up by cuts to state agency general fund operating budgets. And then finally, so those changes between expenditure changes and the revenue changes net out to zero for the biennium. Below the shaded line in the spreadsheet, you'll see the non-general fund expenditure changes. The only one that we haven't talked about is the PEEP expansion that the Department of Employee Relations testified about last week. This is an appropriation from the Health Care Access Fund for $2.3 million. And that's the appropriations section.
Okay. Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to talk about Article 2, the governmental operations article, which begins at the bottom of page 3 of the amendment labeled A061398. Section 1 provides that legislative sessions in even-numbered years cannot begin until the Monday after precinct caucuses. Section 2 is something that was in your bill last year, provides that defines a legislative day as a day when a standing committee of either house of the legislature meets. Section 3 has statutory term limits on committee chairs. Section 4 deals with per diem. It provides that legislators may not receive per diem living expenses for special sessions called for budget matters. This was a bill that the committee heard earlier this year. Section 5 limits legislative housing expenses to 6 months in a calendar year. Section 6 is something that was in the House version of the state government finance bill last year, combined public information schedules and publications. Section 7 provides that legislative expenses of more than $5,000 have to be approved by the rules committees in each body. Section 8 deals with the Legislative Coordinating Commission's duties to study certain matters relating to the economic status of women, and it provides a June 30th, 2007 sunset on those duties. Section 9 is from last year's state government finance bill in the House, encourages the adoption of rules that would provide a system of joint legislative committees. Sections 10, 11, and 12 deal with the councils on the Council on Chicano Latino Affairs, the Council on Black Minnesotans, and the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and provides that the governor, with advice and consent of the Senate, would appoint the executive directors of these groups. Sections 13 going on to Section 32 are all from a bill dealing with the state auditor. I believe that this committee heard the bill. It was heard in the Governmental Operations Committee. And those sections, most of the import of those sections is to have a new definition of political subdivision that would apply all through Chapter 6 and then make corresponding changes. That carries all the way over to page 16, Section 33, which provides that the Attorney General may not provide funds or other assistance to a county attorney or other local government prosecutor for purposes relating to prosecution of an election or campaign practices matter. Section 34 amends a new section of law that was new last year dealing with public websites. The new law last year prohibited links to certain political websites, and this section grants an exemption. It allows public libraries to provide links to those political websites if it's done for nonpartisan and educational purposes. Section 35 deals with an account in the Office of Administrative Hearings that is used to fund their duty to hear fair campaign practice matters, and it provides that balances remaining in the account at the end of the first year carry forward to the second year. Sections 36, 37, and 38 deal with the topic that Ms. Roberts mentioned earlier in her spreadsheet. This is creating the open statutory appropriation to fund the State Board of Investment. This was in the House bill last year, and it is repeated this year. Sections 39, 40, and 41 all deal with modifying a new law that was enacted last year that provides that certain small businesses and small units of local government can obtain temporary exemptions from rules that exceed a certain cost threshold. Section 39 takes that threshold down from the current $25,000 down to $10,000. Section 40 requires that entities that are getting temporary exemptions will be reported to the legislature by the agency whose rules are affected. And Section 41 provides, under the current law, the governor can issue waivers for certain rules, and Section 41 provides that that waiver authority will expire on June 30th, 2007. Section 42 is a moratorium until January 1st, 2009 on agency rules that will cost businesses or units of local government more than $10,000 in the first year after adoption. And it basically says that an agency may not adopt a rule if the cost threshold would exceed $10,000. This is a moratorium until January 1st, 2009. Section 43 deals with the cost of state agency rules on state agencies, and it provides that if the costs of the state general fund to an agency for administering, complying with, or making payments under a proposed rule in the first year would exceed $10,000, then the rule does not take effect until the legislature passes a law authorizing the rule. Section 44 is part of Representative Lanning's bill on per diem for state boards. It authorizes per diem of up to $66 if time spent is more than 8 hours per day on board activity. Section 45 deals with executive branch advisory councils, committees, and task forces, including councils of color, and it provides that if any group covered by this section fails to achieve a quorum at three consecutive regularly scheduled meetings, then the group is abolished immediately. Section 46 is back to Representative Lanning's bill. This is the same per diem change of up to $66 per day for advisory groups. Section 47 amends the current law, which has a uniform expiration date for expiration of advisory groups, and it moves that date to 2007. The current date was a now obsolete 2003. Section 48 deals with agencies, state agencies, that require applicants for an occupational license to appear in person to take a test. It provides that agencies that do this have to offer the test in at least three sites outside of the metropolitan area, and it encourages agencies to develop tests that can be administered online. Section 49 also deals with occupational licensure. It provides that an agency that issues professional licenses has to notify its licensees of changes made to laws or rules administered by the agency under which a fine or other sanction can be imposed. Section 50 authorizes public agencies to use volunteers to provide services and provides that a governmental unit can't enter into a agreement that restricts the ability to use volunteers. Section 51 applies to legislators and other elected officials, and it provides that they cannot receive more than one per diem from all public sources for any one day. It also provides that the amount of per diem paid by a local government unit may not exceed the amount authorized for legislators. Section 52 deals with historic publicly owned buildings, and it provides that an executive agency or a political subdivision may not sell a building that it owns that's listed on the National Register of Historic Places unless it first gives the Minnesota Historical Society 2 years to study the use of the property and requires the Department of Administration to conduct an inventory of the property and contents to determine its value. Section 53 specifies conditions under which members of the legislature and the governor forfeit salary if budget bills aren't enacted. This is the provision that you discussed last night. Section 54 is the traditional provision dealing with parking spaces in front of the Capitol. Section 55 and some subsequent provisions move the state fiscal year so that it would run June 1 to May 31 instead of July 1 to June 30th. Section 56 is a bill Representative Cornish sponsored that allows state agencies to prepay for boat slip rental. Section 57 is a requirement is that the Commissioner of Finance estimate the amount of general funds to be spent during the biennium for programs that are supported by an open appropriation. It then provides that if the agency administering it anticipates that the amount estimated will exceed 5% or more of the forecast general fund expenditures, then that agency is authorized to make certain changes to bring the forecast expenditures in line with the previous estimate. Section 58 is a bill that you discussed last night, Representative Seifert's bill, that would require the governor's budget to report full-time equivalent employees by program. Section 59 provides that as part of the governor's detailed operating budget, the governor would submit a report comparing major spending programs in Minnesota to similar programs in other states. The threshold is $10 million or more of general fund spending. Section 60 forbids a state agency from charging a new fee to schools. If the new would be meaning any fee that wasn't in effect on July 1, 2006. Section 61 is part of the change of the state fiscal year. Section 62 puts a 10% limit on administrative spending for people receiving grants from the state. Section 63 requires grant recipients, as a condition of receiving state grants, to list the position and salary of each employee whose salary is more than the salary of the governor. Section 64, page 31, is part of the change in the state fiscal year, so is Section 65. Section 66 is Representative Loeffler's initiative, requiring the Commissioner of Administration to maintain an inventory of historic state buildings and providing that new appropriations for renovation of historic buildings in the capital area must not be recovered through rent charged to tenants. Section 67 is a requirement that the Commissioner of Administration adopt rules establishing a building code for the renovation and rehabilitation of historic structures. Section 68 provides that a person is not eligible to receive a state contract if that person has been convicted of a crime for knowingly employing illegal aliens in the United States. Section 69 requires the commissioner and state agencies to consider purchase of goods and services in the United States, and to do so when this would be in the best interest of the state. Section 70 requires state agencies to consider buying used goods if this would result in best value. Section 71 deletes a sunset on a current provision that requires cost-benefit analysis of certain state purchases for projects over $50 million. Section 62 deals with professional and technical service contracts and provides that some conditions on those contracts don't apply to contracts that provide for services of volunteers. Section 73 is the same thing for service contracts that are not professional or technical in nature. Section 74 deals with reverse auctions and allows reverse auctions for all services other than services for construction, architectural, or engineering services. Section 75 authorizes the Commissioner of Administration to award a bid preference to motor vehicles manufactured in Minnesota. Section 76 provides that, to the extent practical, a state agency should buy open source software. Section 77, excuse me, Mr. Chair. This is the intent statement for the public buyers group. This was Representative Pepin's bill. And also Section 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, and 84, and 85, and 86 are all from Representative Pepin's bill, the PEEP bill that this committee heard, renaming the program the Public Buyers Group. Did this committee hear the bill, or was it? Or am I confusing it?
We heard the bill, but I believe almost every member didn't want to change the name of the program, so I think if you could make a mental note to draft an amendment to not change the name.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, over to page 40, section 87. This is part of the state auditor bill that I mentioned earlier, dealing with the change in some housekeeping language in the state auditor's statutes. Section 88 provides that if school boards authorize the use of credit cards to pay for a meal, the card may be used only to pay for a meal by the one person that the board authorizes to use that card. Section 89 authorizes the governor to appoint a state poet laureate. Section 90 deals with the $35 annual statewide hospitality fee imposed by the Department of Health. It provides that the fee does not apply to a special event food stand and does not apply to schools. Section 91 requires the Commissioner of Revenue to maintain toll-free telephone access for taxpayer assistance. Section 92 provides taxpayers an option to pay more taxes than are due on their tax form. Section 93 on the top of page 42 deals with the Unclaimed Property Act and provides that if the Commissioner of Commerce determines that the department has custody of property that belongs to a local government unit, the commissioner must transfer the property within 20 days of receiving it and determining that it belongs to the local government unit. Section 94 is dealing with charitable gambling, and it provides that for licenses renewed in a prescribed period, organizations can carry forward an amount equal to 15% of expense, of a positive allowable expense carry forward amount, and it states that the balance must be used to offset future negative expense balances.
Mr. Chair, can I just answer the question? I see that we have, not that they can, but that they shall carry it over, shall carry 15%. Is the intent to be allow them to do it or mandate that they do it?
This is language that Mr. Barrett and Mr. King had worked out, but maybe we'll have them chat about this. Make sure, maybe it's not clarified properly.
And Mr. Chair, I did misspeak. It does say shall.
Okay.
Section 95, Mr. Chair, strikes language that prohibits linked bingo games at bar bingo occasions. Section 96 establishes a new section of law. It regulates cumulative and carryover pull tab games and authorizes the board by rule to regulate these games. Section 97 deals with a report. The Commissioner of Revenue and the Lawful Gambling Board would develop one form to report specified information. Section 98 allows cumulative or carryover prizes up to $2,500, so that these would be, this would be different from the single pull tab limit of $599. Section 99, onto a new subject. This is requiring the Public Employees Retirement Association to establish two funds that political subdivisions would use to hold money to pay for post-employment benefits other than pension benefits owed to officers and employees. This is a state auditor initiative, and it carries all the way over to the top of page 46. Section 100 on the top of page 46 deals with county boards, similar to a change earlier for school boards. If a credit card is used to pay for a meal, it can be only used to pay for a meal eaten by the one person that the board authorizes to use the card. Section 101 amends the existing, there's an existing deduction from TIF increments that are distributed to authorities or municipalities, and this adds an additional purpose for which this deduction can be used, and that relates to compliance reporting for the Job Z zones and the cost to the state auditor of examining and auditing the Job Z zones and business subsidy agreements. Section.
Can I just ask? But that section, does this have to go to the tax clerk committee?
Tax chair was just here. I don't believe that it does, but.
I don't want to lose it when I'm.
Otherwise,
just make a note of it.
Okay, we will make a note of that one. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, Section 102 deals with municipal contracting, and it allows the use of reverse auction for engineering, architectural, or construction services. Section 103 deals with town road construction and permits a town to piggyback onto a county road's construction contract. I'm sorry. I misspoke. It permits a town to piggyback onto a county.
The other one, the reverse auction.
Does not allow it.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I apologize.
That was from last year's bill where we kind of said that we didn't want engineering services to go through McDonald's process.
Okay. Restate it that it allows use of reverse auction for services other than engineering, architectural, or construction. Thank you.
I'm shocked that anyone's listening to you.
No, I didn't do it on purpose. Section 104, again, is the Uniform Municipal Contracting Act, parallel to the earlier change for state contracting, provides that a person is not eligible to receive a local government contract if they've been convicted of knowingly employing illegal aliens in the United States. Section 105 is also parallel to an earlier change for state contracts, and it says that a municipality must consider purchasing used goods if this would result in best value. Section 106 is the same change with credit cards, but this time applied to city councils or town boards. Section 107 amends a law that was enacted last year about out-of-state travel by units of local government. It provides that policies adopted under this section that were required by last year's law must provide that travel can be disapproved by a majority of the members of the governing body. Section 108 provides that local government newsletters or other publications of general distribution can't contain photographs of elected members except for face and shoulder photographs. Section...
Mr. Chairman, can I ask why that is?
It seems that's like... not my provision, Representative Mollery. I think that's a parallel state law has something. When Representative Kahn or somebody was chair of the committee, there was some... for commissioners that were running for governor and all this kind of thing, so it parallels what state law is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean,
I think it's
you want to put
it. Forest is the one that brought this up. So when he gets here, let's let okay. him explain it. It's not my deal. Represents over. Actually, a lot of this isn't my deal. So if you, we'll.
I've had a groundbreaking ceremony. They can only show my face.
Yes, crazy.
Sure.
Not the shovel.
Yeah. I don't think it affects you, Representative Solberg.
Well. With the mayor.
Interesting. Sure.
Okay. Mr. Chair, on the bottom of page 48 and the top of 49, section 109 forbids a unit of local government from imposing a fee based on a person's status as a post-secondary student or on a post-secondary institution based on the number of students attending. Section 110 is part of the change in the state fiscal year. Section 111 is the land sale provision Ms. Roberts mentioned earlier. Section 112 authorizes the Commissioner of Administration to convey to a local unit of government some real property at the Brainerd Regional Treatment Center, and also authorizes some ancillary transfer of personal property that the Commissioner of Human Services has determined isn't needed for their operations anymore. Section 113 requires an RFP from the Commissioner of Administration concerning some of the commissioner's responsibilities for providing real estate management services to state agencies. Section 114, it requires the commissioner to issue an RFP for a private entity to conduct a study of light vehicles owned by executive agencies. Section 115 that is related and requires the commissioner to issue an RFP to assume responsibility for maintenance and management of vehicles owned by executive agencies. Section 116 requires the commissioner to issue an RFP seeking a private entity to assume additional responsibilities for performing services for state agencies. The commissioner would determine the services subject to this RFP, but the value would have to be at least 2% of the total value of services state employees provided during the current fiscal year. Section 117 is related to the ability to pay more taxes on the income tax form mentioned earlier. Section 118 deals with state agencies that have been required to adopt rules since the 2003 legislative session and that did not publish notice of intent in a timely manner and therefore lost the ability to adopt their mandated rules. This section says that notwithstanding the time limit, they must adopt those rules. Section 119 requires studies and reporting on the potential for converting Minnesota public pension plans from defined benefit to defined contribution plans. Section 120 is the ratification of the labor contract and compensation plans that you discussed last night. Section 121 is a moratorium on state agencies imposing new fees or existing fees during the remainder of this biennium. Section 122 is a task force to study the restoration of Victory Memorial Historic Drive. Section 123 is a requirement for the Commissioner of Administration to examine current office space lease agreements for councils of color that have offices in the metropolitan area and requires co-location of these councils in one building by January 1st, 2008. Section 124 is the sports-themed tip board pilot project that you heard earlier with the language forbidding the gambling control, the gambling control board and the attorney general from spending state funds to defend a lawsuit.
Oh.
And Section 125 is a repealer of a definition of political subdivision in the state auditor's chapter because there's a new definition earlier in this bill. Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Okay. Ms. McKnight?
Mr. Chair and members, Article 3 deals with elections and campaign finance law changes. The first section amends the non-campaign disbursements under Chapter 10A, and it adds to the list of these disbursements the cost of a magnet less than 6 inches in diameter that has legislator contact information on it and is distributed to constituents. The second section increases the spending limits for constitutional officers by 20%. It appears to be a larger amount. That's because you may remember there's a cost of living indexing that goes on, and the numbers that are in the statute now are not the numbers that apply for this year. But it is a 20% increase in those spending limits. Section 3 gives a candidate their opponent's share of public subsidy if the opponent declines spending limits and public funding. Section 4 says that a candidate can file a statement with the Campaign Finance Board indicating they do not take political contributions from political committees, political funds, or lobbyists, and then requires the board to post this information on its website. Section 5 increases the size of contribution that a candidate can take from political parties. This goes up for governor, lieutenant governor combination. The election year amount increases from $20,000 to $50,000. For attorney general, the amount increases to $20,000. For secretary of state and state auditor, this amount increases to $20,000. And for legislator, the change goes to $6,000 in election years and $2,000 in off years. Section 6 applies the session fundraising ban to special sessions as well as regular sessions. Then Section 7 goes with that. Section 8 requires candidates to sign their spending limit agreements earlier. It changes that deadline to 7 days after the close of filing for the office. Section 9 prohibits the legislative caucus from issuing political contribution refund receipts if the caucus accepts $25,000 or more from one donor. Section 10 comes from House File 1948, and it requires the school board to adopt a policy that prohibits school districts from using public resources or students to advocate passage or defeat of a ballot question. Section 11 changes the definition of major political party. It does this by requiring a party to run a U.S. Senate candidate when the office of senator is up, and that's for purposes of meeting either the 5% test or the slate test for being a major party. Section 12 reduces from 15 to 5 the number of Election Day registrants that a registered voter can vouch for, and it also amends the provision on using tribal identification documents for Election Day registration. The significant part is that the ID card now must be issued by a tribal government of a tribe that has a reservation located in whole or in part in this state. And there, it provides options for a document that doesn't have your address on it, in which case you could use a separate document that has your address in addition to the tribal ID. Section 13 is House File 865, Representative Olson's bill that you heard last night, dealing with precinct boundaries when there's been an annexation. Sections 14 and 15 are from Representative Emmer's bill that requires polling places to be designated for a 12-month period and not to be changed within a calendar year unless there's no other space available. Section 16 deals with election judges, and it requires municipal clerks to enter specified information about individual election judges into the statewide voter registration system and then electronically certify to the Secretary of State that these election judges have been appointed pursuant to law and have received their required training. Section 17
As part of House File 3833, Representative Hilty's bill on post-election review, and it deals with the Secretary's access to polling place rosters and voter registration applications for post-election monitoring activities. Section 18 is the Minnesota Voters Bill of Rights provisions that were amended in Representative Westrom's bill that you heard about last night. Section 19 puts a limit on dates for holding elections and requires that they be held the first Tuesday after the first Monday of any month unless some other date is specified by law or unless some other date is required in order to meet the deadlines for filling a congressional or legislative office vacancy. Section 20 is another issue. This is a separate Representative Emmer bill, but it's the same theme of requiring polling places to stay the same during a 12-month period. And this one, I think, is amending the school law. Sections 21 and 25 come from Representative Westrom's bill that you heard about. There's several sections that are technical sections. Last year, efforts were made to allow the use of a specific kind of voting equipment, which is now not going to be used. So there are several sections in this article that are just going to take out references to something that's no longer needed. And that's sections 21 to 25, for starters. Section 26 comes from Representative Heidgerken's House File 2608. It exempts towns from providing handicap-accessible voting systems at their March town election if no other election is held at the same time. And it would require this kind of equipment to be available if a town resident makes a request for it from the county auditor. Sections 27 to 29 are more of that striking references to this voting kind of equipment that we're not going to use. Section 30 deals with change in current law requires local units of government to obtain certification and submit a plan to the Secretary of State about their compliance with requirements for electronic voting systems in light of HAVA. This section exempts municipalities from meeting these certification procedures and from filing a plan this calendar year if the municipality has a population under 10,000 and the county auditor of the county has filed a valid plan. And Section 31 is another one of those striking references to the equipment that is not going to be used. Section 32 is the post-election review bill that Representative Hilty has that you've heard about. Section 33 is another one of those striking references to equipment that isn't being used. Section 34 is the same as Section 38, and this is kind of this will be an opportunity for the committee to clarify some confusion. Both of these sections are the same. They create a voting system working group. And originally the provision, I think, was put in statute and made permanent. The Senate then adopted this as a working group that's temporary and going to go out of business. House Civil Law adopted this, and I can't remember in which form because we had both amendments in our packets, and I'm not sure actually which one the committee adopted. This document, by an error that the reviser and I together made, puts both forms in. So you will have a choice between making this statutory or temporary, and you can direct by amendment take one of those out. But this is the group that it's part of Representative Westrom's bill, and it's going to advise the legislature on what to do about voting systems. Section 35 amends the disclaimer law, and it exempts from the disclaimer law a magnet, sticker, or button that is less than 6 inches in diameter. Section 36 amends the law on soliciting.
That's all buttons.
You gotta do those big buttons.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. McMahon.
Mr. Chair, members, we're up to Section 36, and it deals with soliciting near polling places, and it makes, I think, about three changes. It expands from 100 feet to 300 feet, the distance from a polling place that individuals have to stay when they're displaying campaign buttons. It then expands from 100 feet to 1,000 feet, the distance that an individual has to stay when trying to influence voters. And finally, it prohibits keeping a record of individuals that are arriving at or departing from the polling place. Oh, actually, I guess this is sort of two parts. And then it prohibits within 100 feet of the polling place asking if an individual has voted in the election. See, Section 37O deals with the refreshment law. Last year, first of all, there's a bribery law that says, as you know, that candidates and people working on campaigns can't give voters anything, can't give them treats specifically. Last year, this law was amended to allow for refreshments worth up to $5 to be consumed on the premises at a private gathering or public meeting. This section, I would say, is clarifying this, that the refreshments are intended to be provided for consumption there. In other words, not just given there and taken away, but provided to be consumed there. Section 38 is the second version of that voting machines option that we talked about. Section 39 deals with the HAVA account funds. In 2003, the legislature created this Help America Vote Act account to hold the federal money that was received to buy for voting equipment. This section would appropriate what's left in there to the Secretary of State and make that available until June of 2009.
For what?
I assume for its original purposes, but this provision doesn't say.
That's a good question. So we'll have them talk tomorrow about what that's about.
And then finally, the repealer, does a couple of things. The first repealer, it eliminates the cap on how much carry-forward money a principal campaign committee can have. The second provision in there, the 10A273, just goes with expanding the session fundraiser to special sessions. The repealers of 204C50, that's the post-election review law, and it's repealed from 204C because it's going to move into Chapter 206. And then the session law repealer is the... It goes with this HAVA account fund in Section 39. And Article 4 is conforming amendments for that limitation on the dates that elections can be held.
Okay. Are you handling the veterans, Mr. Shepherd, for Mr. Cleary? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to talk briefly about Article 5, which starts on page 92 of the bill. This is a military and veterans article. Section 1 is the bill you discussed last night from Representative Bruce Anderson, which deals with the salary differential program for state employees, and it broadens it to include some of the public health workers and the morticians that you were, as an example, that you discussed last night. Section 2 is a state, deals with state parks, and it exempts military personnel stationed outside Minnesota from the requirement to purchase a pass to enter state parks during their military service and for 90 days thereafter. Section 3 deals with medical school exams, and it lengthens from 7 years to 10 years the time frame for a medical student to take the U.S. medical licensing exam if the person has been mobilized into active military service during that process. Section 4 is a bill, I believe, that was carried by Representative Welty in the Governmental Operations Committee, and it authorizes people to take unpaid leaves of absence from their employer for certain purposes related to a member of their family being ordered into active services. This is 1 day in any calendar year. Section 5 is a policy statement in the National Guard chapter of Minnesota statutes. I believe you might have discussed this last night. Representative Severson's bill. Mr. Chair, Section 6 is something that I believe you also discussed last night. I think this was Representative Wardlow's bill for soldiers who are ordered into active state service, giving them the same job protections that federal law would provide when they're mobilized into federal active service. Mr. Chair, Section 7 is related to the Representative Welty provision that I had discussed a minute ago. This is a cross-reference in the section of law dealing with veterans. Section 8 of the provision is some higher education provisions. Subdivision 2 directs the U of M and MinSCU to recognize courses for an award educational credit for a veteran's military training if they meet standards of the American Council on Education or the equivalent. Subdivision 3 directs the Higher Education Institute to treat veterans as Minnesota residents for undergraduate tuition purposes, and specifies conditions under which graduate students would be treated as residents. Subdivision 4 waives late fees and other late charges for veterans in certain circumstances. Mr. Chair, Section 9 is clarifying a statute that protects occupational certification or licensure of some military personnel who enter into active service during time of war. It provides that a person's occupational certification does not expire during a time that they're serving in active military service and for 90 days thereafter. Mr. Chair, Section 10 to 12 is the provisions that you discussed some last night and that I think Mr. Cleary was going to look into clarifying. This deals with the regulation of ownership, possession, and use of machine guns and shotguns by security officers employed by the Minnesota National Guard. Section 13 is dealing with memorial plaques in the Court of Honor. It authorizes the placement of two plaques on the Capitol Mall. One would honor all military war dogs and their handlers, and the other would honor Minnesota's Medal of Honor recipients from all wars. That concludes this article, Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, we have the walkthrough completed. We want amendments are due by what time, Mr. Shipman, did we say? Sometime tonight or tomorrow morning. We'd like to have amendments. We are going to have, there's a couple pieces that are going to get deleted out of here. I'll talk to the minority about what they might be. So if there might be some things you're wondering, where did this come from or what is this? And there's a few pieces that'll be ripped out of here right away tomorrow. So we're going to have discussion about this tomorrow. I know some questions already came up on the shall carry forward and things on the Mr. Barrett provision, so we need you to kind of answer that question privately or publicly. And we'll have all the amendments in the markup tomorrow. Okay. Any questions so far? Representative Blaine?
I'm just, as we come to the end of... As we come to the end of the bill here, and then on page 101 with the memorial plaques. Now, I was just curious whatever happened with Representative Tao's bill on the Hmong Memorial.
I believe that is going to be funded in the bonding bill, so that's a separate situation. These are very minimally expensed items that will be provided free of charge from someone that wants this. Good question.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Representative Mullery,
Mr. Chairman.
We're actually going to switch the agenda on. We're going to take the Hackbarth bill on the Heritage Amendment up next so we can hopefully get that marked up and out of here by 10:15. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, we were going to discuss the De La Forest and why.
Oh,
I don't understand.
What page was that on, Representative Mullery? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
That.
I can't remember. I just think it, if anything, we should do the opposite.
Is a provision relating to credit cards, Representative De La Forest?
No. There's a provision related to photos.
Local government people could only be the headshot.
Page 48.
Is this being attributed to me, I guess?
I think so.
You're blamed.
Blamed was a better word.
I thought you had an answer for the question, why, what the deal was there.
Sorry, I can't, Mr. Chairman, claim authorship of that language.
All right. Well, we might just delete that out.
Good idea.
Okay. Why don't we why don't we either orally or if you can whip up something to just delete that out, why don't we just do that? Okay, anything else, questions before we... Okay, why don't we, we'll lay that aside. Members, we're going to mark up the bill tomorrow morning. And the intent is to finish in the morning, and we're going to stay until the bill is done tomorrow. So one way or another, it's going to be out of here. Okay, we're going to switch the agenda around, and the Representative De La Forest will move that... Mr. Shepard, do we have possession of the Senate file right now, do you know?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe it was referred down on the floor yesterday, but Mr. Listig might know for sure.
Okay.
Members, we do have possession of the Senate file, so we will move that Senate file 2734 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, that the House file be indefinitely continued, and that way we will insert the House language into the Senate language, so we've got two bills that are matched up entirely. Representative Hackbarth, welcome. We have, I believe, the product from the Tax Committee. I'm not sure that anyone in the room supports what came out of there, but we certainly want to...
Mr. Chairman, the chair of the Tax Committee who voted for this bill is here.
Okay. All right. Very good. We do have one.
I wish I supported it in total, but...
Did the bill have to go to tax?
Representative Krenke, there is a question about...
You can probably ask that privately.
We'll do that. Okay, we'll worry about that privately. That was something else.
Chairman?
Representative Mallory.
Just when you're asking that one, there's also in here changes in tax forms, and I can remember the Department of Revenue coming in and saying that they couldn't find any space, and you're putting in more room on there, so that should also have to go to tax.
Okay, we'll ask that question. Now, keep in mind this committee does have jurisdiction over the Department of Revenue, and Representative Kahn knows the age-long discussion about who has jurisdiction over the Revenue Department. It is this committee, not the Tax Committee. Representative Hackbarth, we've moved your bill, and the Senate file is before us, so I believe that you would like to take the House language and insert it into the Senate bill.
That'd be correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that'll be the first motion, would be to insert the language from House File 1909 into the Senate File 2734 to get the shape so we get to start with something. Any discussion on that?
Mr. Chairman, that's as it came out of the Tax Committee?
Yes, that'd be identical, yep. Any discussion on that? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those nay. Okay, we have the Senate file amended with the language from the Tax Committee. Representative Hackbarth, if you could quickly walk through your bill. We are going to try to limit testimony today as much as possible. I think everybody knows kind of where everybody's at, but we still want to have the public be involved as much as possible. So we would like to have an hour on this bill, not 5 days on this bill. And so we're going to try to keep it to a limited discussion if we can. There's a fiscal note of $6,000. That's why the bill is in this committee to start with. So the fiscal note is being passed around to members. Representative Hackbarth, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm going to start with explaining what I originally brought to the Tax Committee, which was a 1/8 of 1% of current state revenues from the sales tax being dedicated to game and fish and outdoor heritage and conservation issues. And that changed dramatically in the Tax Committee over the three days of hearings. It is now a 3/8 of 1% tax increase, and it's got arts and trails and parks and numerous other things added to it. And in addition, a couple of other constitutional issues that were added to it. The DOMA language was added to the bill, and also a change in the MVET tax amendment that was going to be before the voters this coming November is also now currently in the bill. So that pretty much wraps it up, members. I'd take any questions if you have any questions at this time.
Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, do you support the bill in its present form?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I would like to see some changes made.
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, when do you intend to make those changes or ask for those changes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I believe there is going to be an amendment today.
Mr. Chairman, if we're going to see an amendment that we vote on, shouldn't that be what we're looking at before we listen to testimony, if there is going to be an amendment in this committee?
Okay. Does someone have an amendment for the bill?
I do.
Representative Deal Forrest, is it in the packet or where?
No.
Okay.
I believe so.
Okay. Why don't we hand it out? It's being handed out.
It's
okay.
The amendment that is coded H1909DE19.
Okay. This is a delete all amendment, so we'll try to get this. So when we're finished passing it to members, if we could put it out so the public can get a copy of this, would be very helpful. Representative De La Forest, while we're handing it out, why don't you explain what this does?
Well, essentially, Mr. Chairman,
I would start by noting that I certainly support Representative Hackbar's concept and would hope that we would have a clean bill. But what my amendment would do essentially is take this bill back to the original Hackbar language, but it would still keep the 80-20 and the DOMA on there. As I said, I would prefer to see a completely clean bill, but I know how to count votes, and so I believe that while this certainly isn't the last chapter, I'm hopeful that this starts to move the bill back towards what the author and I want it to be.
Okay, discussion on the amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Solberg.
Before you do any vote, just 1 second.
Sure. No, we can hold on.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg.
I think we should have a roll call on this amendment.
Okay. All right. A roll call's been requested. Thank you.
And the difference now is the tax policy. Is that correct?
Is the tax an increase? Is that taken out, the tax issue?
Well, you know, Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, Representative Hackbart, this goes back to his original language. He's probably the better suited to answer the questions regarding his language.
Well, this isn't his original language, because his original language had just didn't have DOMA in and didn't have the constitutional amendment for other things. What I'm asking the author of the amendment, are you taking out the increase, the ability to vote on an increase in sales tax?
Okay. That is correct.
Okay, this language takes out the increase in taxes and goes back to the original bill.
It would go back to taking from the existing sales tax.
Mr. Chairman, can you ask a question then? Who's going to pay for that next year? I think that was a question that was asked in the tax committee, as I recall, when it was voted on. Where that money is going to come from? Are you going to take it from education or grandma in the nursing home?
Representative Hackbarth, do you have an answer for that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Solberg, the original language and in this amendment, it put the effective date out to 2009. Sales tax revenues are continuing to climb continually, and it gives us a buy-in into plan for this if the voters should approve it on the November ballot.
Okay. Well, and Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, I can't help that comment pass. I was in the tax committee to hear this debate, and it isn't exactly the high road, in my opinion, to increase the sales tax either. As we both know, that's the most regressive form of taxation, so I wouldn't consider it to be the high road either to increase the sales tax.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what we should probably be doing then is increasing the income tax and dedicating that, if that's what you want. But, you know, this comes from the Missouri plan. We had testimony in all seriousness in the Missouri plan that we touted as being the salvation of the environment. And they have done a great deal, a good job in the three areas. But the Missouri plan, when it was voted, was an increase in their sales tax. And it's also dedicated to three things, if I recall right, fish and wildlife and forestry. And it also funds their bureaucracy. Missouri plan that dedicates the sales tax, the increase in the sales tax, I think they testified in the LCMR task force that, if I recall the number right, I might have it wrong, but that it funds 1,111 employees. And the question was asked, well, do you give grants out then to, you know, for environment? And they said, well, a little bit. But it's really the funding of the bureaucracy. That's all it is.
Okay. Representative Mullery?
Well, Mr. Chairman, to pick up on where Representative Solberg is going, this was touted as a great idea by Representative Hackbarth and tax because of Missouri. Well, Missouri not only does that for using sales tax for this, but they also use it they dedicate a large part of it for schools, and they dedicate a large part of their income tax and sales tax also for local government of their general taxes. So if we're going to start copying Missouri, then let's start copying Missouri, which is dedicating a lot of your general taxes. It's going back to what actually the Republicans were smart enough in Minnesota a long time ago to get rid of in this state, and which has gotten other states into trouble.
Mr. Chairman, there's one other question that was asked the task force of the people from Missouri, and that was, did you have a budget difficulties the last year? And yes, was the question. And the question was then asked, well, did the bureaucracy that's funded by the dedicated have any layoffs? Oh, a couple. Well, did other agencies have layoffs? Yeah, lots. Did you cut education funding? Yeah. But the bureaucracy of the Missouri DNR continued on.
Well, Representative Solberg, Mr. Chairman, I can't speak to Missouri's plan. Perhaps Representative Hackbarth can with more authority, but I think we simply have a difference of opinion. I am not convinced that our state budget is so thin and so lean and so efficient that we can't find funding for what I consider to be a very critical need.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if it's such a critical need, we should have found the funding for it. That's absolutely correct. When I chaired the Ways and Means, we had an increase of over above what the governor recommended for the Department of Natural Resources and the Environment. So if the will is there in the corner of the state capitol, it can be found.
Representative Hilby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackbarth, in answer to Representative Kahn's question about the current state of the bill, you said you would like to see some changes. Does this amendment represent the only changes that you would like to see?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, it gets back to the original 1/8 of 1% without a sales tax increase. It does have my original language in there. Am I crazy about putting the other two constitutional amendments on there? No, I'm not. I would like to see those removed. But like Representative DeGlafora said, he can call votes, and we'll move on from this committee and try to make some changes elsewhere.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Representative Hackbarth, a question. Do you strip out everything in this except the welfare for hunters part? In other words, you get rid of the clean water legacy, you get rid of the arts, you get rid of public radio, parks, public parks and trails, public television, all of those are gone under this amendment. Is that correct? It's hard to read through this real quick while we just got it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory, the David's Amendment is now out of the bill. That is correct.
This amendment takes out...
I think it was the Atkins Amendment that ended.
It takes everything out. All right.
And just as a point, Representative Hackbarth, you said that we can expect and we should plan for increases in the sales tax, but at the same time, you're one that always votes against taking into account increase in employees' salaries. Does that mean that we're going to keep salaries steady forever, and yet we're going to take into increase expected increases in sales tax?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory, I think we have to look at each budget every year differently. There's room for increase in salaries for state employees, then we'll have to look at that and increase them if the money is there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, you want to guarantee that we do a welfare for hunters, but you don't want to protect state employees that way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory, I think because of the increases that we give education and because of the increases we give in transportation and health care and health and human services and other areas of state government over the last maybe 8 years, I've seen those particular areas of state government increase. Where I see the increases decreasing is in the environment and natural resources area, and those budgets are being decreased. The amount of increases are decreasing. So with that, Representative Mallory, this is a stable source of funding for these particular issues, and you know, this should be the year of the environment, Representative Mallory. We can do this bill, get it on the ballot, and let the folks vote on it, and it would be great for the Minnesota environment. We could have done a bill on the floor yesterday, a mercury emissions reduction bill, and that would have been great for the environment in Minnesota, and we weren't able to do that. We also have the Clean Water Legacy issue that Representative Osmond's going to be bringing forward. I hope that gets passed without being fooled around with. This could be a great year for the environment, Representative Mullery, if people would get on board and get some of these things done.
Mr. Chairman, the most important part of this bill, the clean water, you just stripped out with agreeing with Representative De La Forest's amendment here.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of an unusual procedure where we take a bill that came from taxes that made changes in the tax provision, then we totally reverse all of the actions that the tax committee did, and is the next motion then to send it back to taxes to reconsider their misinformed actions?
Well, Representative Kahn, I don't think it's unusual for one committee to entirely change a bill. We do that in GovOps every day, as you know, because you're the one doing it. I don't see it as unusual. The motion would be to send it to Ways and Means and move on from there. Or we'd have bills going back and forth from. We'd never get any bills to the floor because every bill changes as it goes to committee almost.
Well, this bill has been sent here because there are three $2,000 appropriations to put constitutional amendments on the ballot. I don't think we're supposed to reinvent all of the tax policy that was done in the bill, but maybe I should ask the tax committee chairman what he thinks about that.
Public broadcasting a tax issue, Representative Krinke?
Well, let's just talk about the obvious tax issue, which is the direction of the tax and the size of the tax.
Representative Krinke?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to see the bill back in the tax committee. It was there for 3 days. I think we have some other work to do in the tax committee, and if we have that process when the bill gets to the floor, I think people have ample opportunity to offer amendments, Representative Kahn. So, not all work is done in committee, and certainly not all good work is done in committee.
Okay, we have the amendment before us. Why don't we? Is there anyone that feels compelled to speak on the amendment that has the urgency to testify?
Yes.
Okay, come on down. Mr. Edmond, welcome to the committee. And this would be on the De La Forest Amendment.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. My name is Larry Redmond. I am here today representing Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, which are basically all of the arts organizations throughout all of your districts, throughout all of the state, indeed. The organization itself is over 30,000 people. It represents roughly 1,400 arts organizations that are in every corner of the state. Minnesota is blessed by having one of the most diverse and most extensive arts networks throughout the state, throughout the nation, rather. I should add that in Minnesota, we consider the arts to be one of our most important resources. It certainly, we think, is of the same level of importance that we think, frankly, the conservation issues that are presented here. We're very respectful of those, and we think that Representative Hackbar's efforts on their behalf is certainly an appropriate one. And the arts community thanks him for his efforts on those matters, because our natural resources are indeed very important. But the work that human beings create is also one of our state's great natural resources. And Minnesota has been blessed by that. Small towns use the arts as a building block to bring people together. In rural Minnesota, it's a very significant thing, building block, in terms of trying to show people that they have some identity and their communities are going to continue to flourish in the future. In the metropolitan area, the same phenomena happens in neighborhoods, and it should be added that for our large employers, the arts are a significant source of ensuring that we have the kinds of people come to the state and keep people in the state that we need to continue our vibrant economy. 14.5 million attendances take place to the arts every year in Minnesota. This is extraordinarily significant activity. We don't opine today on the revenue source question so much, so we understand the sensitivities that are there, but we believe that the arts do belong in this bill. The arts have been significantly cut over the last few years.
When the state had a 14% operating budget deficit a few years ago, the arts were cut by 32%. Those cuts we understood we thought they were too great, but we understood the difficulty the state was happening. But too often the arts is one of those areas that is short shrift in the state budgeting areas. We think, as Mr. Hackbarth has, I think, appropriately spoken in regards to conservation needs, that stable funding is an important thing to this very rich and important part of the legacy of the state. We understand that the primary functions of the state are always going to be health and human service, education, public safety, transportation, and so forth. But we also understand that these particular activities are very, very crucial to our people. It's an important resource, and we would urge you to continue to keep the arts as part of this constitutional amendment.
Okay, Mr. Redmond, thank you. Are there questions? Representative Krinke?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Redmond. When this issue came before the committee in Texas, I guess I didn't ask this question at the time, but obviously, having chaired this committee where we did fund the arts, and I think we have funded them at increasing levels when I was chair, but was there legislation introduced to dedicate sales tax to the arts and to the other entities that are currently in the bill as it's presented before the committee, or was this just a piggyback action that occurred within the last few weeks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, I believe that there are two other files that were introduced in the House over a month or more ago that did include the arts in its funding. I believe Representative Osmond's original file, it was taken out later, included that, and I believe a bill introduced by Representative Hansen. This particular amendment to Representative Hackbarth's bill was done in the Tax Committee as a separate matter, but I think in keeping with those other introductions.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Redmond, my question, though, is to the... I know that... well, let me back up here a moment and say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbarth, how long have you been working on the issue of trying to dedicate sales tax to our fishing, hunting, and access needs in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, 1999.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Redmond, when did the idea of first dedicating sales tax to the arts and to all of the other parks and trails and other entities that are currently listed in the bill, when was it first put on paper and introduced as legislation?
Mr. Redmond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, I believe in terms of introduction in this bill, I believe it was this year, but I might add, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Krinke, that I believe Senator Cohen in the early 1990s, might have been the 80s actually, had a separate introduction that would have dedicated money to the arts from lottery proceeds. And I believe the first conversation that I ever had in which the sales tax did came up took place in 1977 when we first began trying to increase arts funding, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Redmond. Is there anyone else that would like to come on down and like to testify?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley. I'm here today representing the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. It's an association of all the larger public radio stations in Minnesota, except Minnesota Public Radio, who does their own thing. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity to say a couple of words. I would just like to say that add my voice to the support of the combined recreational and special interest community that was part of the bill as it came to your committee. The public radio stations that I represent have thought all along that they support the arts, they support hunting and fishing, they support everything. But if you're going to set aside special revenue streams for recreational interests in Minnesota, that you should consider everybody's recreational interest. And we are committed to be a member of of the large group of people that have worked to pass this issue on the ballot this fall. We've looked back over the years. Historically, most constitutional amendments do not pass. It takes a pretty cohesive effort and a lot of people working together to pass constitutional amendments. And we are committed to being a part of that, and we are just asking for some support to remain part of the bill. We'd like to commend Representative Hagbarth with his vision and his diligence, and we would like to join his effort to spread the base of support through more Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Tilley. Mr. Stuzinski.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Spresinski, and I'm here today representing the interests of Minnesota Public Television, which are owned and operated in communities throughout the state of Minnesota. We, too, would like to thank Representative Hackfire for his commitment and to the environment, and we appreciated Mr. Hackfire's bill as it came out of House taxes. Public television in Minnesota has certainly, like other budget areas, been cut over the last several years. We, as well, have played our particular role when things have been particularly tough. We understood all of that. We've gone layoffs. We've done layoffs. We've done all those kinds of things recently, even. But let me put this in perspective for you, what the original bill was when it came in this morning. Public television in Minnesota reaches almost 4.2 million people in this state. 2.5 million people each week watch public television, take advantage of the wonderful programming that's on it. It is a very good alternative. And in fact, public television is truly a community resource. We run nightly news programs. We provide programming in areas where the people can't even get commercial television. It's a big resource owned by the public. Well, let me talk a little bit about wants and needs. Public television, from our perspective, is not just what people want or budget issues what you want. There are a lot of people who are shut-ins, disabled people, people who are senior citizens, people who no longer enjoy and appreciate walking in the parks, going out to the hunting blinds, going fishing or whatever, enjoying the environment, but they can enjoy it through programs provided on public television. So we think we're important. We serve an important role to thousands and hundreds of thousands of citizens in Minnesota. We also have about 200,000 individuals that contribute money to public television throughout the state. As you know, thanks to the legislature, in part, we have now gone into the digital environment where we are providing much more programming than ever before. We're dedicating programming to the Minnesota Channel, for example, which has expanded legislative coverage. We'd be dedicating programming to educational opportunities, and et cetera. But this bill, as it originally came in, provided a stable base of economic support that we think is extremely important. Now, I've represented public television. In fact, the first time I testified in front of this committee was in 1973, so I've been here for a while, and I've watched these things over the years. But I've represented public television since 1982 in this state, and I've watched the funding cycles and how it's gone. We need a stable base of economic support because we rely also so heavily on matching contribution. This bill, as it came in this morning, would certainly provide that stable base of support. Well, I guess I'd like to simply conclude by saying, while there are no assurances that the amendment you have before you would pass the voting electorate with the capacity the public television offers, and we think the support, 80% of the households in this country take advantage of public television and like it, and it's extremely important to them. But with our support, we also believe we add a lot to this and can help ensure that amendment, as it came in the committee this morning, would pass the public. We're happy to, we're willing to put our resources to it. Mr. Chairman, I thank you. That was my testimony. But we thank you for the bill that originally came in, I guess.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that feels compelled to testify? Okay, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Judy Erickson. I'm with the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota. And I just want to thank Representative Hackbarth and the others that have worked on this legislation since the late 90s. Parks and Trails were a part of the original discussion back in 98-99 with Senator Lussard. I remember him calling me into his office to talk about this proposal and funding state parks and trails. It was quickly, we quickly brought in the Metro Parks and Trails people, and it was the Habitat and Parks and Trails back at, the last few years. It's only been recently that Parks and Trails has not been included in the bill. And we are I'm here today to ask you to continue supporting Minnesota's Parks and Trails. They are a wonderful asset to our state. Our state parks and trails, our metro parks and trails, and our local parks and trails all complement each other. They are places that give us, our citizens, access to some of our most outstanding natural and cultural and scenic resources, places to recreate and to enjoy solitude. At a time of increased emphasis on physical fitness, parks and trails provide great opportunities for active and healthy living. Today I'm just asking you, as you consider this amendment, that we would ask for your continued support of keeping parks and trails in this legislation. We too have lost 30% of our general fund spending, and working with citizens across the state, there are tremendous needs out there in our parks and trails. And we, this funding is very critical to a long-term healthy park and trail system in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Okay, is there anyone else that feels compelled to testify on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, is there any discussion on the amendment? Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this amendment as it stands is doomed to failure, so I'm going to vote no at this point. I've had lots of discussion with my friends in the natural resources area, and at first I sort of sided with them that we ought to keep it, but, well, one thing that I completely say is unless it's an addition to the sales tax, which will be voted on by the public, it's going nowhere, because people like me, even if I'd like a broader base, the one thing I will not tolerate is I will not tolerate the idea that we're taking it away from all of our existing existing activities. And I also won't tolerate that we're going to wait for 2 more years to wait, let the money mount up, because the expenses mount up at the same time. You know, that argument just makes no sense, to think that with the tax revenues will increase, but that the things that we spend them on will not increase in cost. So someone like me, who will be running a vigorous campaign in a district that's likely to vote yes on this, the whole thrust of that campaign will be to vote no because of the fact that you'll be taking it away from our senior citizens, taking it away from nursing homes, taking it away from child care. And the same people will vote who would have happily voted no to add, just, you know, the discussion of breath is another issue, and you know, but they'd happily vote for an increase in funding for these issues, will not vote to take that increase away from other things that they think are very important in the state government. So, you know, I'm going to vote no today, but I think it's a fatal flaw to put it on the ballot, because districts like mine, where you need a heavy vote to pass this kind of thing, will be voting no on it, whereas they would be happy. As you just look at what happened, look at what the vote count is in the areas where they passed increased funding for recreation and for wildlife and wetland preservation and so forth. Those are areas with very heavy voting percentages, and you'll get a very heavy bipartisan vote to do that. You will get, those are the kind of areas that will vote no on this takeaway bill. The other thing that I've shifted in agreement to, at first I agreed with the proposition that we should keep this a clean natural resource, you know, which included parks and trails and habitats and clean water and so forth issue. And then I thought about the effect of having this on the ballot. And in a sense, if you balance the desire, with a very small part of the balance going to things like public television and arts, you bring in a whole set of other people who are going to vote for it because that's what they want. Once people think about it, you don't lose a single vote of the people who want clean water and the people who want game and fish and so forth, because they see it as their only opportunity too. And they look at how much of the proportion that they're getting at the ballot. Plus the fact that in terms of raising the money to, and everyone knows that a ballot initiative, just ask the states where they have, you know, many on the ballot each year, but a ballot initiative takes money to pass. There are going to be three of them there. If this bill passes as it is, there are going to be three ballot initiatives, which makes it likely that all of them are going to fail. But the point is, you have to raise money to do it, and I would submit to the members of this committee and to the audience that the arts community is a very good place to raise some of that money that would be needed to pass the ballot initiative. So I'm voting no on this because I think it blocks the commitment. I've signed on as a co-author of the Osment bill, which I strongly support in its original form, and I think this bill does great damage to the process that we've had in the House so far.
Okay. Any other discussion on the amendment? No. Representative Solberg has requested a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Blaine? Yes. De La Forest?
Yes.
Binstadt?
Yes.
Hilty?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Krinke?
Yes.
Mullery?
No.
Pepin? Solberg?
No.
Seifert?
Yes. There being six ayes and four nays, the amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments for the bill? Does anyone feel compelled to speak for or against the bill? The motion is to recommend that Senate File 2734 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion on the bill as amended? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The bill is passed and its title agreed to. Congratulations, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you very much.
We are going to move on to the next bill, which is Representative Bisgen's bill. Is Representative Bisgen's in the room? Representative Olson, is he in the room? He's got a bill here, and he's working on some type of an agreement with the townships. Representative Bisgen's bill, I believe, is non-controversial. It passed unanimously out of the GovOps committee. So perhaps we could bring it up. I know Representative Kahn, the state auditor's office, is here. Representative Kahn and I have heard this bill already. So the chair will move that House File 3380 be recommended to pass. And did we have a fiscal note on this, Ellen?
It's coming around.
Okay. Be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
This has been very confusing.
Oh, wait a minute. Well, I guess there is no fiscal impact, so. Okay. Members, we have a blank fiscal note, so I think we're going to send this to the General Register. So,
Mr. Chairman, there is a local fiscal. There is some local.
Okay, we will send it to Ways and Means, all right? Okay, we have a author's amendment, so we're going to send this to Ways and Means. We have an A8 amendment. Would the State Auditor's Office like to explain what this does? This is the Bisgen's Bill 3380. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, Carla Heil, Deputy State Auditor. The amendment essentially gives comfort language to the local units of government that this bill does not affect health savings account, medical accounts, other individual accounts, and it's clearly stated with this amendment.
Okay. Does anyone have a question on the amendment? The chair will move the A8 amendment. Seems innocent enough. Okay, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, the amendment is adopted. Do we have any other amendments that you're interested in? Okay, could you please walk through the bill for us?
Mr. Chairman, this bill relates to creating trust to fund requirement of other post-employment benefits. Quite often it's going to be health insurance that has been offered to public employees. This is a larger issue at local level than in the state government, and under the Government Accounting Standards Board starting in 2007, they'll have to list their liabilities of these post-employment benefits on their books. and this is a vehicle so that they can create trust to set aside the funds that are necessary to pay these post-employment benefits. They are not required to put their money in trust. They can keep it at their local level, but if they create the trust, it will be through PIRA and SBI. The reason the bill is drafted this way is SBI has higher rates of return than the local units of government generally would have, and PIRA is able to administer these at a very, very low cost to local units of government. And also, if it's with PIRA SBI, there would be very little oversight requirement by our office. So that is the short summary of this bill, Mr. Chairman.
You have questions from members on the bill? We did have some discussion about Duluth. We know we have the Duluth legislators. They're very much in support. Could you give us just a quick overview of why, what's going on up there and how this bill helps that situation?
Mr. Chairman, the city of Duluth right now, you have to do an actuarial study to find out your post-employment liability. The actual actuarial study is for 30 years. Duluth, presently, their actuarial study came to $280 million. And if this bill passes because you use a higher rate of return, it is estimated that their actuarial liability would go to $180 million. Duluth is probably the most well-known, but we know, for example, that the Met Council has $350 million of outstanding liability, and other units of government are just now doing their actuarial studies. But that is... Duluth's level right now is 280. That's probably the highest for a single unit.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
A point of clarification is then that figure in Duluth is a 30-year obligation. So that if everyone retired, that's what it would be. Is that what it is? Based out over 30 years.
Mr. Chairman. Representative, it is a 30-year number. It's a continuing, so it covers their present payments and through 30 years down the road, 2037.
Mr. Chairman, is that
Representative Solberg?
Is that a normal type of study or normal type of accounting for actuary accounting for retirement plans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative. These post-retirement benefits, their actuarial studies are quite similar to pension funds' actuarial studies, which is also based on a 30-year study.
Thank you.
Okay. We have someone who's requested to testify, Steve Johnson. Come on down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Johnson, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. I'd like to thank Representative Biskins for working with us on this legislation. I'd like to thank the Auditor's Office for meeting with us and working with us on this legislation. I'm here today to speak in opposition to one provision of the legislation, the exclusivity portion of the legislation. And I want to make that clear. We're all supportive of the ability of local governments to be able to set up these trusts, but the portion that allows does not allow banks with trust powers to get into the business, if you will. We are in opposition of that. Just a couple comments. Banks are very heavily regulated industries. Banks go through an extensive exam. Exam process. Banks with trust powers actually have additional regulatory burdens, if you will, or regulatory regimes, if you will. So they're very heavily regulated. We're audited on a regular basis, so we believe we have the regulation in place to handle these. We're very active in our communities. The banks in many communities are the heart of the community. We'd like to keep these types of funds in their communities to build and grow and maintain our communities. So And a lot of times these local governments want to work with us in this area. So bottom line is we'd like to be able to least bid on these type of accounts. If the State Board of Investment is the better investment that the local government chooses, and so be it. But we would just like to be able to have the choice to be in the process. So,
okay, so Mr. Johnson or the State Auditor's Office, who has the money now, and is it deposited all over in banks and so forth, and now it's going to be consolidated in SBI?
Mr. Chairman, at the present time, most units of local government are not even funding this. And so those that have, they would have it in their local banks. And the intent is that they now have to start funding it. In the past, it's been pay-as-you-go. This requirement is to start funding it. So the intent would be that under the proposed language, that it goes to PARA and then through SBI. But at the moment, if they are funding it, it would be just in their local bank. The big difference is local units of government can only basically invest in bonds and short-term money. If, in fact, you create a trust where you want a higher interest rate, they do not have that authority, and that is also why this legislation is written. And SBI has the experience with investing in that and also at the lower cost. And this issue has been discussed at two previous committees. With the cost, PARA and SBI, they can have annual administrative costs of 0.26%. We assume that the bankers with their trust and investment is like 2%. We're talking about outstanding liabilities of local units of government that is going to be over $5 billion. And if you put that in context, that's actually more than our present shortfall in our pension funds. And if you look at having, you know, the same rate of return with the bankers and with SBI, but with the lower administrative costs, it ends up being a $2 billion difference. You could end up, if you put $580 million away this year, you'd end up with $5 billion in 30 years with SBI, $580 million this year at with the bank, it's $3 billion. That's a $2 billion difference for administrative costs.
Our resident math teacher represents Solberg.
Wow, that's always net present value may not be the same numbers 30 years from now. $2 billion might be buy you a cup of coffee. We don't know that. But Mike, Mr. Johnson testified that they wanted the banks to be able to bid on it, and in that opening process, they are able to give a better rate of return, why would we not allow that? Can you give me some justification?
That's a good question. If they were to lower their administrative handling costs and give a better interest rate, why would we not want that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, we have looked at how local units of government have performed, particularly with the volunteer fire release, where they have the same authority as the State Board of Investment. Their rate of return has actually been 2 percentage points lower, actually 2.5 lower than the State Board of Investment. And it's not just volunteer firefighters investing. Instead, they also do hire their bankers, investment advisors, consultants, and they still come lower than the SBI. And with the administrative costs, we already know PARA and SBI is very low. As you know, your fiscal note to the state is nil. They are here to testify if you would like on that issue. And more importantly, even if there is an occasional government that does better than SBI, in the past 8 years, 94% of the volunteer firefighters have done worse than SBI. Only 6% has done better. Mm-hmm. And overall, that is millions of dollars to the state and to taxpayers. So for the few that beats it, it's a detriment overall to the state and its taxpayers.
Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, does this, I'm not quite sure what this covers. Does this cover all the volunteer fire relief issues? Does it cover all the paid fire relief and so forth?
Chairman, Representative Kahn, This is related to trust funds for post-employment benefits. It's going to be cities, schools, counties, towns. It does not cover relief associations. It's similar to the extent that it's a 30-year obligation. It's just a comparison, but it does not relate to fire relief.
Well, why are we giving data? Why are we being given data on fire relief if this doesn't relate to fire relief?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, the question was if local units of government can do it better than SBI, and well, for the comparison with the numbers that we have, when the local units of government have invested on their own, they haven't done as well.
Well, I think comparing the volunteer fire relief to local units of government is, you know, kind of an apples and oranges comparison, particularly since we have 730 some different pension plans. And I don't, you know, I've usually been in favor of consolidation. I've certainly been in favor of, and one of the problems with Minneapolis is teachers, is that Minneapolis teachers wasn't given the option to invest in the State Board of Investment. And I certainly think it makes sense to give everyone the option of investing in the State Board of Investment. I'd like to do more thorough investigation of the ones that are proceeding so badly and get more information on it. And so I'm certainly, you know, and I think that the to say that the volunteer fire relief are doing very badly, but we're not doing anything with them, to my mind, doesn't make any sense in this legislation, when some of the things I've worked on have tried to get more control. But I think the simple answer is, okay, if we make this a preferred path, that we want this to be with the State Board of Investment, and, you know, I know I followed the State Board of Investment on some really kind of rotten things that they did. And there are entities that have much better return than the State Board of Investment, you know, with because of different restrictions on. For example, the Yale University Board of Investment has a much better rate of return than the State Board of Investment, and so maybe we ought to turn everything over to the same kind of managers that that Yale University Board of Investment has for their endowment fund. But I don't understand the request that's simply made right now from Mr. Johnson, was it? Yes, from Mr. Johnson, that, okay, we use this as the norm, but then we allow any bank to bid, any local bank to bid on matching it. Because there are reasons. For example, the local bank can do what the State Board of Investment doesn't do, which some people say they should do, is they might decide to go totally with index funds. And so you're completely losing any of the extra fees and items such as that. Now, the State Board of Investment doesn't go with index funds, and one can argue whether that's a... We've had this argument back and forth about how much they should be on index funds. But I, even though I used to be very strongly in favor of consolidation, I actually like the idea of having some differences out there so that we can look at... So that we look at those differences. I mean, I do remember when the year that the Minneapolis Fireman's Fund was the highest of all the investment funds, and that's a pretty big fund. It's much better than most local units of government. And why were they so high? Because all the esteemed financial advisors were saying that the hotshot thing to invest in was foreign investment. And one of the guys on the Minneapolis Fire Board said, I don't like that foreign stuff. I think we should stick with American stuff. And so they did sort of a buy American. And so they did do that, and that was the year that foreign investments pulled every other account down, and they were way up. You know, they looked like geniuses that year. Now, you know, so what would this bill lose if we amended it? And I obviously don't know how to do that right now. But if we amended that to what Mr. Johnson has suggested, to set this up this way and allow, look at the State Board of Investment, what the State Board of Investment is offering, and then allow any local bank to match that or outbid it.
What would you leave?
What say you?
Mr. Chairman, we've, in response to Representative Kahn's question, you know, in short, the state auditor feels very strongly with the language that we have in the present bill, that it's para and SBI. The question is, what do we lose? You know, our numbers are based on the past experience of other entities, and we look at overall the cost, where it's $2 billion difference for local control and choice over 30 years if there's a different rate of administrative costs. You look at the higher rate of returns, and you also look at oversight. And you look at the cost effectiveness for the taxpayers overall. I believe that's what we lose if it is changed.
Well, the problem is, you're looking at that from looking at the volunteer firefighters, and yet you're not taking over the volunteer firefighters. So it doesn't make any sense to me. The place that you get your data from is a place that you're not taking over. So I would think, listening to all this argument, they said, oh, great, someone's finally taking over the volunteer firefighters. But you're not. You're just going after places where you have no data, and you're not even allowing us to look and get some data on.
Is there something that could be worked out between here and Ways and Means? There's four of us that are on there that could, what are you envisioning, Representative Kahn, like some type of a carve-out?
We have to go out today. I don't think we don't have.
It'd be nice to.
Well,
Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, one of the things that I would like to do is I asked the question and been listening to the debate and the testimony, is that I think we should give some opportunities for the communities to have some choices, but then see if indeed 5 years down the line that they have performed as they've said they were or have not performed. So put some pressure on them also to be able to do the bidding if they so desire, and then also make sure that they are performing as they have indicated that they could. And I don't know how to do that today. And I don't know if it does irreparable harm. It's Representative Biskin's bill. He's not here to react to my question.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Krenke.
Well, I have some concerns about this legislation from the standpoint that by us mandating that local units of government have to invest in SBI, that somehow we then have some tangential connection to the stupid mistakes they make.
Yeah.
And as Representative Kahn has been talking about the Fire Relief Associations, the problem is that we continue to reward their bad behavior through police and fire aid. I think we need a provision in here that says that the state in no way has any obligation to meet your unfunded liabilities whatsoever. Because, as I said, these cities and counties are handing out post-retirement benefits that they have no methodology to meet. They just hand out the candy and say to these people as they're leaving public employment, we will continue to pay your health care, we will continue to give you post-retirement benefits, and they have no method to pay for them whatsoever. And then, as we see, we have cities who come to the state legislature who want the local option sales taxes, who want more local government aid to fund their stupid decisions. So I have a problem with the bill because it doesn't have a provision that says we do not incur any obligation or any connection to fund the stupid mistakes that local government make.
Well,
thank you.
Stupid mistakes are always in the eyes of the beholder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, you've been here longer than I have, and you understand the difficulty of, I don't care, we can say stupid mistakes the legislature makes too, because we make plenty of them, but the point is that any unit of government that continues to hand out benefits, and it goes for
There are private corporations that do the same thing. They continue to hand out benefits to people without any methodology or any legitimate way of paying for future obligations.
Okay, we don't even have the author here, so we've got members who are, you know, wondering where he's at, and we don't even have him here if he wants to try to work on this. We are literally out of time. We've got people coming in for the next committee meeting. So we are going to lay this bill over potentially for this afternoon. It would be highly recommended if people could work something out with Representative Visgins. I think that would be nice. We are going to meet this afternoon for the Olson bill and potentially this bill at 1:30 p.m. in room 300 North. Please save the omnibus bill draft in your packet as well as the bill summary, and save the Visgins bill and the Olson bill for this afternoon. The committee is in recess.
And we will continue with Representative Visgins' bill from this morning, House Bill 3380. The motion is that it goes to Ways and Means. We haven't heard from Ways and Means, but they need to see it because there's no general fund impact according to this fiscal note. Representative Visgins said he'd be willing to go to the register and get re-referred to Ways and Means. I don't have any preference on that. What say you, Representative Visgins?
I say aye, Mr. Chair. I don't believe there is fiscal impact to the state, and I would prefer if this committee would move the bill to the general register. I will visit personally with Representative Knobloch, and if the Chair of Ways and Means would recall it back to his committee, we would gladly appear there.
Okay. All right. So the motion will be that the bill be recommended pass and be referred to the register. Okay, Representative Duncan, welcome to the committee. I believe that this amendment is A8 adopted this morning. Okay, that's been adopted, so the bill is in proper form. The auditor's here today as well. Is there any other questions that you or concerns you have that you want to bring up, or should we let the testifier come up that wanted to testify?
Mr. Chairman, we're here to answer any questions you might have, so if you want to bring up the testifier,
let the testifier and gentleman that has signed up. Sorry about not getting in this morning. We just literally ran out of time. Thank you. If you could give us your name and organization for the record, that'd be helpful.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Aaron Casper, and I represent not only myself but National Insurance Services regarding this bill. Basically, I wanted just to indicate to the committee, Mr. Chair, that I'm in opposition to this bill for a couple reasons, and I've got some points that I'd like to make regarding the bill. First of all, as written, this bill does not allow for free market forces to function. This bill removes competition from the marketplace and removes the local government's ability to choose the most effective solution based upon their specific needs and goals relative to this issue of GASB 45. Additionally, in mandating PERA and the State Board of Investment as the only option, this legislation would remove the ability of private sector providers from providing their guidance and expertise to public entity clients throughout the process of implementing an effective GASB 45 solution. Additionally, passage of this bill will completely eliminate private business interests in areas such as banking, insurance, brokerage, and administrative services. And in some cases throughout the state, these are the same organizations that support the local communities in which we all work and live. And finally, there's nothing in this bill that addresses what happens to those public entities that have been on the leading edge of GASB Statement 45 implementation and have already implemented the new standard early and established irrevocable trusts and began funding their annual required contributions as according to GASB 45. In wrapping this up, my testimony, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to also make the distinction that Representative Kahn made earlier this morning, is that there is no correlation between using rates of return for the potential impact of GASB 45 funding and pension historic pension rates of return. Pensions are funded on a consistent basis. It's arguable whether or not there need to be additional funding towards them, but there is nothing that is in existence today that allows for public entities to actually invest in variable investments relative to this issue. So drawing a comparison on rates of return is very difficult to do.
Okay, do we have questions for this witness? Okay. See none. Thank you for coming in. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Representative Bisgins, we may have had some author questions this morning. Representative Kahn had some, but I don't know if she has any that are left for the author or the auditor. Were you finished, Representative Kahn, this morning? I know we kind of cut it short.
I guess one of the issues is that this is that optional? Is that if they want to invest in these, and I didn't quite understand that.
Can the auditor,
they want to keep their, they want to continue with their pay-as-you-go, or if they want to continue with their investment in bonds, then they can stay. Then there's no requirement. I thought it was a total requirement for them to go to the State Board of Investment. That makes me a little bit more comfortable with it. But
either the auditor or Representative Bisgins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, this is, I'll spend a few seconds refuting the last testified. This is, this isn't going to change the bank or the bank relationship that banks may have with local governments whatsoever. Local governments can still invest in bonds. They can still have their accounts. Local governments currently do not have the authority to set up trusts. They don't have the authority to invest in anything other than a list of things that you've created as legislators, which is generally bonds, cash, mortgage-backed securities, and so on. So it's not going to change anything that is currently law. What this says is it adds the option, the possibility that local governments may, if they choose, set up an irrevocable trust through PARA and through the State Board of Investment, like they currently do with their pensions. Currently, there's a relationship they have with PARA and the State Board. It's a completely optional thing. There are many entities that are going to still do pay-as-you-go. Hennepin County is going to do pay-as-you-go. Some are going to just keep putting money in bonds and savings accounts through their banks. And some, like the City of Duluth was one example, and Ramsey County is another, they are going to be much better off pre-funding this, investing the money through a state-approved investment account, the only one that we have currently for local governments, which is PARA and the State Board of Investment, and earning a higher rate of return on their dollars. But again, it is completely optional. We are doing this to help create options for local governments to deal with these issues. We wrote this language with the local government entities. They are in support of this. And if they want to continue to buy bonds through their local bank, they can.
Representative Solberg has a
comment. Is that right? Mr. Chair and Madam Auditor, I'm sorry I was tied up in a meeting, and I know you wanted to meet with me. I apologize for that. It's over in the Capitol. But your testimony is that they have options to do it. They either have an option to pay as you go or go into PRA, that they couldn't do the trust with the bank. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. They currently do not have any option to do any trust whatsoever. So this is expanding their authority to allow them to essentially set up a trust and an irrevocable trust and to put those dollars into an investment vehicle that earns a higher rate than your average cash account or what you can get by buying bonds as a municipality.
Well, I understand the city's investments, and there's some restrictions on bonds that they can invest in the bank, but for the retirement account is what I think you're trying to address here.
No.
Okay, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Auditor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Local governments, all local units of government can only invest in a list. I have, maybe you can hear me. By statute, can only invest in certain vehicles, generally which are bonds, money market accounts, etc. And there's a reason for that. That is the fiscal policy of the state. The reason is because these are taxpayer dollars and they should be invested in low-risk investments. There's
this is a power, long-standing policy of the state and of the state legislature. No, I lost my train of thought. What was your question?
What I'm trying to go down is to also, in the testimony we had this morning, mm-hmm. that local banks or other bank financial institutions want to be able to at least offer their services to solve this problem. If the local unit of government looks at DRA investment, that's a decision they would make then. If they want to look at the bank as an investment in this to solve this problem, that's a decision local elected people will make. We heard testimony this morning that, well, the administrative fees may be not disclosed. And so I have an amendment here, and I want you to react to it. And again, there's been about 50 balls up in the air today, so
mm-hmm.
if I don't do this exactly right, I have to apologize.
Okay.
But I attempted to draft an amendment that would allow a bank to be able to pick one of the options, and then at the same time, as our good counsel is so capable of doing on the fly, to also add that the fees that are charged are disclosed, so that people make their decisions with their eyes wide open and all the knowledge that they have.
Mm-hmm.
If the State Board of Investment has got a good record without any question, and it would be prudent for to do it, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have competition. I know you like competition.
In most cases, not in most ones. And I can tell you why.
we'll take up the A5 amendment for discussion purposes at least. So, Madam Auditor, do you have a copy of A5 and represent this one?
With the
handwriting at the bottom. Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you give us some reaction to that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Solberg, I too support competition. I support it strongly. As we look forward to this situation and trying to bring it to fix, I think that all parties involved want to work together on this. But what we're facing right now, Representative Solberg, members of this committee, let me just put it out black and white. All right, we're looking at trying to create a tool. One more tool to help local units of government who have made commitments in post-retirement health care accounts that they have no way to fund except to pay as you go. This is an unfunded liability. Now, we in education, in the field of education, we allowed a few different school districts to have different options rather than go through the state and through PERA. We allowed three school districts, right, to invest their own retirement accounts, and we've paid for it dearly as a legislature. Right, let me put three words that are still in front of us to this day. Minneapolis teachers' pensions, right? This is what we could be facing if, as we look at these local units of government creating different investment accounts. We've rolled these all together as a policy of the state, the retirement accounts. The auditor is looking at this also through a voluntary basis to help fund the these other health care benefits, post-retirement health care benefits, and I think it's a good one. Now, we'll continue to work with this, but I also want to say unequivocally that if this amendment were adopted, it would most likely have the effect of killing the bill this session, to be perfectly honest, because this amendment will indeed come with a huge fiscal note, because the what we would do if we allowed this type of investment is we would now force the auditor into a whole new realm of auditing, right, as she has to make sure each of these little entities and how they're investing meet some level of standard and criteria, right? We can work with this as we go forward. We're just looking at a tool right now to help in what could eventually be a $3 to upwards of $6 billion problem that the state's going to face.
Mr. Chair, let me respond to the last part. I think in the proposal that the chair has put forth earlier this morning, we have a redefinition of a political subdivision, and it gives the auditor all kinds of authority to go in and start auditing joint powers agreements, the small units. I don't think there's a fiscal note with that for some reason. I mean, there's a fee you charge with it, but there's not a general fund fiscal note.
Yeah.
Madam Auditor?
May I respond? We had that authority beforehand. We were just clarifying Chapter 6. So, I think we had the authority to go into any local unit of government at any time and audit and charge back. It was just a clarification and cleaning up the language in Chapter 6.
I don't see where this is a big additional cost to the state auditor, if there's any problem. Mr. Chair, I think Representative Kahn had a reaction to Minneapolis teachers.
You know, when you list that, why don't you look at the fact that there are entities that have often surpassed the State Board of Investment, and there are entities that, you know, there are other local, I know that there are other local investment funds around the country that have surpassed the State Board of Investment. So, that, you know, they're not as perfect. I guess my guess is State Auditor probably remembers her reports better than I do, but I think Duluth has done pretty well. Duluth isn't in the problems that Minneapolis have been in. And, of course, part of the problems of Minneapolis was the inadequate funding at the start from the state, and then the second part is the restrictions, was that they weren't allowed. They weren't given the option of going with the State Board of Investment, which would have been, which would make their criticisms for not following the state Board of Investments a little moot, I think. But,
Mr. Chair?
What was Duluth? Do you remember? Yeah. Then, what was Duluth?
When they had one investment that turned out.
Yeah, this year.
They're still below 100, aren't they?
What?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Kahn. If I came across as being critical of the Minneapolis School District, I'm not, all right? And I apologize if that's the way that came out. All I'm saying is those are the types of issues we're going to leave ourselves open to.
May I also respond?
Madam Auditor.
Thank you. You're right, there are a few that have beat. The numbers we have and the statistics I gave you in a letter I hope you read last week, 94% are worse than the State Board of Investment. So 6% do beat it. Every one of these entities I audit. I audit the pension for the fire relief funds. I audit Minneapolis teachers. I audit Duluth. I audit all these entities. I would have to do the same thing and start auditing all these trust funds across the state every year. And I would end up essentially writing up school boards and city councils and everyone else for violating fiduciary duties. You would have local school boards picking stocks through the banks. That's what this would create. It would allow that to happen, any sort of amendment. And I think that is bad, bad public policy. It is very different than anything the state has allowed. And I wouldn't want it to have any part to do with that. I am trying to help local units of government, to giving them another option to start putting money away in a safe investment that we've all deemed is fairly safe. I do not want to create another 1,000 trust funds out there that we have to audit, that we have to write up. We have these local people picking investments. I think that is just bad public policy. And we have tried in the state to consolidate the funds. There's talk about consolidating the firefighter fund. We're trying to consolidate, you know, throughout history, that's what we have done. And so creating the opposite makes absolutely no fiscal sense.
But right now, they can't go into SBI. Is that what you're saying?
No, they can't do anything except buy bonds. That's all they can do.
Right. Actually, Representative Kahn is a rather savvy investor. We've had, you know, discussions in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You are.
I rely on savvy investors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Have I have Mallory and then Kahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you had said that schools, one of you, I think, said schools investing in stocks, aren't they like cities that can't do that? Or
nobody can.
That's what I thought. And so when I heard that schools investing in stocks, I...
I think what they were saying is that this amendment would potentially allow for basically, I don't know how many local entities are we talking about here that would be picking and choosing?
Thousands. We don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, it would be
all local.
It would be all local subdivisions. Yes.
Some towns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, only if they have that as a benefit.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not thousands.
If you took every town and the state, was there 700?
If they have a benefit, and they don't, I mean,
right.
There's a few. Ms. Unions, I don't want to get out of your
borders. Okay. Representative Mallory, were you finished, or was that kind of clarifying?
That was my first question. I just would suggest, and I think Representative Viskins did clarify that he was not saying that most of the cause of Minneapolis was the investments or anything, because I really went into the history of that, and it was purely lack of state.
Right, we know all about that.
But having done that, and looked at other ones, I'm very worried about what we're getting out there on this situation, and I think we have to put some pretty strong restrictions. I really think we have to do the volunteer fire. There's probably more problems in that, and having read quite a few cases from around the country on pension issue and the liability of the state for it for these types of locals, I'm getting even more concerned about having these local governments making investments and not getting any return, and then we end up stuck with them.
So currently, these funds are going where? We're giving the option for SBI, obviously, with this, but where are they now? All over the place?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pay-as-you-go system, and that's why it is an unfunded liability. So there is no funds being set aside to pay for these accrued benefits. It's coming out of the general fund.
Just I'm wondering, are we taking business away from the banks that they're getting now, or?
As a follow-up, that's what I was trying to get at, too, was that with the pensions, what is it, 35 years ago, we shifted them into off of pay-as-you-go, I think everything except the legislature, but I'm not sure about them. But we've got these others that we've got sitting out there with no regulation. And 35 years ago, the state was smart enough to step in on the pension issue, and we still haven't caught up on this.
Mm-hmm. You represent Kahn and then Solberg?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what bothers me is kind of the hypocrisy of the people sitting around this table, and I don't know if I'd have to go back and pick up the old roll call votes to check it, but I got all excited when I saw that chart, and I said, oh, my God, we're finally going to, someone has the nerve to do something about the volunteer firefighters. And no, it's just being used as an example. It's not. You know, I said, I'd love this bill if I could just put the volunteer firefighters on it, because that's where the worst programs are. And I would guess is that anyone who's sitting in this room who's been there when I've offered amendments on the floor has voted against them. Usually there are about 17 votes for it, including my good friend Phil Cranky. But in fact, I'll just to remind you, and I don't think I've done it, you know, I've gotten so mild, I'm afraid. I just don't do these things. I don't tend not to do these things every year. But I do remember Dennis Osmond getting up on the floor and saying, when I had an amendment, he was either taking something out I had done, or I was trying to put something in, he said, you don't have to even read this amendment. All you know is that if you vote against anything that Kahn is offering, your volunteer firefighters will be happy. So
I remember that speech.
So, you know, I mean, we're talking about this great sense of control, and that we're totally letting this 630, whatever it is, pension funds that, you know, I never even wanted to forcibly take it away. I just wanted to look at it. And we look at it in a more effective way, and we just continually beat down attempts to do that. So, you know, the thing that the state auditor said to me in a conversation that we had that made sense to me is that if we let this go to the local banks and the local insurance company, it will literally be like setting up that many volunteer firefighter accounts all over again. So that was the only thing that made sense to me. But all you people who have totally fought against controlling the volunteer firefighter groups, you know, just sort of be embarrassed at not admitting it as you're voting for this.
Madam Auditor, and then Representative Fulbert.
Mr. Chair, it's much harder to undo something. Representative Kahn, it's much harder to undo something that's done than to stop it in the first place. And so, it's much harder to undo something that's been done than to stop it in the first place. And we're trying to stop it in the first place.
To do the same thing. If this is such a good idea, please, do it all at once.
Please pass the bill cleanly to the House floor. We're so close.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Senate has taken out the whole, as I understand it, the exclusivity section entirely in their bill.
No.
I understand.
What was the question, Representative?
My understanding is that the exclusivity section has been taken out of the Senate bill, and that's correct.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, but it doesn't change the nature of the bill. They took out that little section, but it still is bound by the investment standard, which sets it through. So it actually didn't accomplish what they wanted.
I want to accomplish what they want.
You just made it. They give you comfort.
But they.
I don't know. Well, I'm going to offer my amendment if I could.
You want the regular amendment or the exclusivity?
The regular amendment with the addition to writing down below it.
Okay.
And the reason I'm doing that is given the option for our banks to be able to compete in it, let the local units of government make that decision. I would think most of them will go with the state anyway. But it does also require the banks, because we heard this morning the ability for fees, and this says that they have to disclose their administrative fees.
So, is that healthy?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that since I have consistently voted with Representative Kahn on the firefighter issues, I think I can oppose this amendment and be pure of heart. So I'm
so noted. Representative Hilty.
Well, I don't want you to be pure.
Okay, I'm going to stretch my neck and look over here and see if anybody has anything to say. Okay.
That side that wants the local control is really quiet.
Okay. Last word, Representative Bisgins, the author, and then let's vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I strongly oppose this amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn?
Just let me point out one little fact about the thousands of millions of dollars on the fiscal note that it will cost, is that the state auditor does have the ability to put a fee on any auditing that the state auditor does. So there would be no cost to the general fund to doing this. There would then be a fee that would then go on the entity that was making that investment.
So. Ms. Roberts, is that accurate? Or? Your voice changed.
Not on the pension. We don't let them do it on the pension.
Mr. Chair, in general, the way that the state auditor is funded is that they do bill for their audit services, but they're funded through a direct general fund appropriation. And they bill for those services, and the receipts are deposited in the general fund. So they
we have to do a fiscal note.
I want to make sure I know what I'm voting on here. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, this is a good choice, good government for the local guy. We're just full disclosure.
Right.
Can I add more things?
You know, you're making a good case. Any other discussion on the amendment or questions? Okay. Representative Solberg moves the A5 amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say
nay. Nay.
Share the ayes or the noes cabinet.
Tell us you could be with me once.
I didn't vote against you.
Oh, I heard you.
Motion to renew his motion, House Bill 3380, be recommended to pass with the General Register. If Representative Knobloch, Representative Solberg, you're the ranking member on Ways and Means.
Yeah. Can you have a discussion if this needs to be pulled back the Ways and Means or not? Right now we're thinking it doesn't, but...
I would think it would just a policy.
Okay.
I think that there's no reason for to have it.
General Register it is, and then have a discussion with Representative Knobloch, if you would, please. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill is House Bill 3925. Representative Olson has been working diligently the last 2 days on this bill, and I believe he has an amendment for the committee to take a look at.
Mr. Chair? There was another amendment here.
That was adopted this morning. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
The chair will move House Bill 3925, and Representative Olson, where is this going, or do we have some agreements?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe we finally have agreements on the bill with the amendment that I have here. It's being handed out right now, the A6 amendment. If you'd like to just move the bill, I'll go through the bill. And while the amendments
are... Just a Ways and Means, then?
Since
there's appropriations or not... There's no appropriation. It's
The amendment will basically take that out, Mr. Chair. We're basically making sure that we're authorized to support, we're going to support it through committee budgets in the House and Senate.
Okay.
Senator Higgins has agreed to allow her budget.
But this may be something, if the appropriation is out, that we could potentially put in the omnibus bill if we have some consensus tomorrow, and we have consensus with the people in the room, we could...
Is there an amendment to this?
Okay. So the amendment is A6. The chair will move House Bill 3925. You recommend a pass, go to the General Register. And then the chair will move the A6 amendment. Representative Olson, if you could explain what this does.
The amendment, I'll go through the bill and explain what the amendment does as I do. The first part of the bill, members, is the task force. There's two members from the Senate, two members from the House, from Majority Caucus and from Minority Caucus, three representatives of the cities, three representatives of the township, and then one additional person chosen jointly by the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House to serve as a chair and who could serve without bias. The amendment amends the appropriations language to assure that the committees of the House and Senate can take care of their respective members and provide per diem expenses, per diem payments and expenses to the task force as well as staff support. We have, in the legislative findings, there's one provision stricken that involves consolidation of municipalities and one additional provision that involves encouragement and support for cooperative efforts that involve joint powers agreements. We have very good testimony on that. The amendment will delete Section 4 on page 3, so the cap for the annexation by order or contested annexations is deleted.
Why are we doing that?
Well, I don't know if they're in the room and they wanted to explain it, but we've wrestled with that and wrestled with it and wrestled with it, and the townships would not agree with the cap. And
Townships wouldn't agree to it? Very odd. Okay, why don't we go through the amendment and then we'll bring up testifiers on the amendment, because this is...
We have agreement now.
Okay.
And your questions are good and understandable.
Okay. We'll get to that then. Okay.
In Section 3, we still have the notice for townships of intent to incorporate. We have the notice for cities of intent to annex. And on the next page, page 4, involving annexation by order, we're contested again. There's four additional provisions for relevant factors. I can go through them if you'd like, but there's four additional provisions. And on the next page, page 6, orderly annexation, we have one additional provision and another under orderly annexation, a notice of intent to designate an area. When you get to page 7 on annexation by ordinance, there's a sunset provision in the amendment for that acreage cap. The acreage cap that's currently is at 60 acres, but there's no limit on how many times. This is a 120-acre cap, one time a year per property owner. And that is sunsetted to the July 1st of 2007 date, which is after the legislative session following the report from the task force. So this would be in place until after the task force reports and the legislature convenes. The provision on the bottom of page 7 is simply striking current property tax revenue transfer language, and it's no longer needed because we have another provision in the bill under Section 12 to address that. The joint informational meeting applies to orderly annexation by order or contested only with this amendment. There were some technical concerns found, and they want to address that further in the task force. So that joint informational meeting language now only applies to annexation by order, or in other words, contested annexations. Those are the changes from the amendment and the bill combined. Oh, excuse me, the last provision in the bill, of course, is the Section 13 where property owners may initiate a detachment. That now is a required resolution from the city councils of all the affected municipalities, not just one of them. So I pretty much highlights the bill, what it does, and the changes in the amendment, and that is the agreement we have from all the city representatives as well as the townships.
Okay. My question on page 3 in the acreage cap, to me this would be something the townships would want to stop the 11,000-acre annexations. So let's have our friendly neighborhood township folks come up and explain why this wouldn't be a good thing.
While they're coming, Representative Seifert, I also want to note that we discussed including that with the cap that we put on the other provision, and I'll let Mr. Sulem address that whole debate.
Sulem, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I know it may seem odd that it's the Township Association that is asking to have that section of the bill removed, but it is true. We have brought this language forth to attorneys that represent townships directly in the annexation battles. We have shopped it to our individual members and have reached 100%. Everybody who's responded to us has said exactly the same thing. This cap does not do what everybody intends it to do. It actually has an unintended consequence of potentially working against us, and rather than putting something in statute that could cause problems and limit the discussion of the broader issues that we wish the task force to address, and I think we have consensus with our city counterparts, we are more comfortable removing it from this bill and allowing the conversations in a bigger context to be done this summer as part of the task force.
I don't know if it's cynical of me, but, you know, if you ask attorneys, isn't it in their best interest to have conflict and therefore more business for themselves? I'm not surprised that a group of attorneys would say, well, we don't want to have a cap. Because then there's more business for them to go to more hearings and bill out more hours. I'm just being, just thinking out loud right now.
Mr. Chair, I understand the cynicism towards my private sector colleagues. However, these are attorneys who primarily make their living representing the townships and doing their best effort to fight for their causes in the courtroom. These are attorneys that are trying to avoid the litigation costs and trying to avoid running up the public sector bills. We agree that we need to address the issue, we want to address the issue, but we feel in order to have the proper discussion of the broader context of things, we'd rather do that in the work group. And so with that language taken out, with the amendment as Representative Olson has presented, we have full agreement without the amendment. The group primarily intended to be benefited by the bill would be forced to oppose it, so I would ask for support for the amendment and then the bill as a whole, so that we can go forward and continue to make the good progress that has occurred so far this session, both with the help of Representative Olson and his committee and with my city colleagues.
But what have Representative Nelson P. and Anderson B. had anything to say about this? They've been very active in the cap issue with the multiple thousands of acre proposals coming forward. Have they said anything on this?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have spoken with Representative Anderson, Bruce Anderson. I have not had a chance yet to speak with Representative Nelson on this specific amendment because it came about late last evening and early this morning. But I did speak with Representative Anderson along with other members of the committee that have been working with the township side of issues, and they were okay.
Committee members have questions on the amendment?
In addition to your comments, Mr. Chair, if I may, our goal that we strove for was to find as many consensus items as we could. When we went through the process, it was admitted by members that we more or less set a different standard for townships. Cities presented serious concerns on some provisions. We just dropped them. When we came to this provision, we amended it with some additional language for developable land. It maintained its controversial nature. The township's voice that we still put it in the bill. It was not a consensus item when we put it in the bill. We had spent hours. We had a deadline. We had to pass the bill. I stated at the end of the hearing that we would keep working on it, but we had to move forward with the bill. It was not a consensus item. It's the only way we could reach a consensus. It does not. It's not presented here with the intention that we bind the legislature that they have to accept this deal, but we have reached the goal of consensus items that we could find with the time we had and a task force to continue the work. This is intended to lay a foundation that the work of which will be continued by the task force. And to something else here that I know will come up in a moment, it's my desire, I believe, on behalf of the committee, that we move the bill out to the floor, even though there's not been Senate action. I've shared this with Senator Higgins. Given the controversial nature of this and given the appeal that I've made to members is that I don't feel it's healthy for the institution that we come out and tell everybody you can't amend and people should have that choice. So I'm going to appeal that we move this bill out, take it up on its own, given its controversial nature. And if we survive that process, keep it in the omnibus bill, because it's the only way we can keep it alive and get it over to the Senate. And I've shared this with Senator Higgins.
Representative Hilty and Finstead, who have townships, are you amenable to this amendment, getting rid of the cap on...
You have townships too, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I do. I don't want to hear from anybody when we read in the paper some town is annexing 11,000 acres and then I could have did something about it today, and particularly when it's the townships asking to have it removed, which strikes me as really odd. But
I'll let Mr. Sulem address that, but I believe he's been asked to produce a letter so that they're on the spot. But, Mr. Chair, it's not my intention, because members have voiced concerns to me about it from the committee. This is a committee bill. I'm telling members that if they feel very strongly about this provision and they want it in there, I don't believe it's healthy for the institution to say you can't amend.
Right.
If members want to do that, that's their prerogative. That's why we'll carry this individually and then see what happens and hopefully be able to keep it in the omnibus bill following that.
Mr. Chair, to address that the specific issues, the reason we're asking for this language to come out is while we appreciate the concern and trying to put a cap that would restrict the 11,000, 12,000 acre petitions that we have seen a couple of in the past year, this language does not actually do that. What it says is 1,920 acres of developable land, and in at least one of the situations that we were trying to address in the past year, much of the city argument was based on, well, yes, we're asking for 12,000 acres, but we only intend to develop 2,000 of it. And so as drafted, this language doesn't prevent the large acreage petitions. It doesn't address the bigger issue of where that acreage is and how that area will be serviced post-annexation. It just simply says no matter what the size of the petition, you have to limit the size of the development. And so while the intent is admirable, it does not achieve, and we have shopped around to make sure we're not reading it wrong, and the practitioners have told us this, the parties who have gone through the annexation battles have told us this. We understand the desire, but this language does not achieve what everybody thinks it achieves. It actually could work against the intent, which
the city groups have testified that is not their goal either, but that's why we wish to, rather than battle it now, rather than try to argue what we intended the language to mean and lock ourselves into potential corners, we are far more comfortable removing this language with the understanding, and we're working on a letter to state this, that we fully intend to keep the broader issue alive as part of the work group discussions.
We can't just get rid of the word developable and just say we're not going to take more than 1,920 acres of land.
Mr. Chair, to that point, we offered language, and I could get that for you if you like very quickly. We offered language to define developable so that it couldn't be abused, and that swampland and lakes and so forth would not be accounted for in that definition.
Well, it sounds like this has been agreed to, so I don't know if anybody have anything else, otherwise we'll just move on with the amendment.
I'll just tell my township people to talk to Mr. Sulem, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair.
That is fine. Okay. Representative Pepin, you've got kind of a developing area out there. What do you think of this?
Well, Mr. Chair, I live in Hasson Township, last township in Hennepin County, and I wish I would have thought to contact my township to see what they thought of it, and I'm wondering if you have any information for me as to who may or may not support this. Obviously, all the townships aren't going to be in agreement, but if you have any more more information.
What do we got? One left in Ramsey. Is it White Bear? Is the only one left? White Bear Township is the only township in Ramsey County. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, yes, I do believe White Bear may be the last known Ramsey, and unfortunately, it is here in the Seven County metro area. You are starting to see we lost Chanhassen at the end of last year through a OA agreement comparable to what Hasson is doing now with the City of Rogers, that in 20 years they'll cease to exist. As with any membership organization, particularly one of our size where you have nearly 1,800 members, it is not possible to get a response from 1,800 individuals in a very timely manner. However, we have sent this out through our board of directors and their districts. We have sent it out through an email list that another organization of a cooperative of townships that are working together only on annexation issues sent it to their email list, and the responses have been universal. Take this provision out.
Sure.
And I'll be happy to take the fall. If anybody gets calls from the constituents, by all means, send them to our association so we can explain why. We'll be putting in our newsletter why we support the bill with the amendment brought forward and why we would have to oppose it with the language left in.
Mr. Sulem, since you did mention that you are aware of what's going on with Hasson and Rogers, could you educate me a little bit about what this would mean, what language would mean for my area?
Is this language relevant to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, nothing in this bill will undo, and we were very careful on both sides to make sure we do not undo any of the orderly annexation agreements. And my understanding with Rogers and Hasson is that it is covered now. An orderly annexation covers the entire remainder of the township. So this bill would actually, it doesn't help, it doesn't hurt, it just leaves the status quo for your one remaining community township.
An amendment to maybe undo that? Or?
I'm thinking, you have any suggestions for me?
I don't know, I'm sure Mr. Shepard could think of something. Why don't we just put this amendment on, unless there's any other discussion? Is there an incorporated change we have to say to the, Mr. Shepard, on line 1.3?
Mr. Chair, yes. It looks like a couple of more words needed to be deleted to make the grammar work.
Okay. So we'll incorporate the change adding to the on line 3 after the word fund. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll incorporate that. Representative Olson.
Another point. I didn't catch this until right on the fly here, check with council and Mr. Searle and Mr. Sulem, but I think on page 2 we no longer need subdivision 2. Lines 9-15, we can change the funding mechanism.
Mr. Searle, Mr. Sulem?
If we did keep it, we should change the shell to new as an option, but I don't think it would be necessary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, it's our understanding that both Senator Higgins and Representative Olson have offered up their staff to replace the staffing provided by the Coordinating Commission, so we have no objection to that. I won't speak for their staff, but we have no objection.
Okay. So you'd like to delete subdivision 2 on page 2?
That's correct.
Okay. we'll incorporate that in the amendment. Any other discussion? Those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. On the bill as amended, did you have something you'd like to add that we probably should have some consensus agreement at the table, just so we know?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I represent the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'll be brief.
Well, that's fine.
I do want to thank Representative Olson and members of the local government committee. They showed a tenacious effort in trying to bring forth legislation to address annexation issues. To be frank, you know, this bill is a consensus bill. There's not a whole lot in here for cities, but we were willing to work with townships to address many of the concerns that they've raised over the years. We think that there are a lot of good provisions, good government provisions in the bill that allow for better notice for folks that will be affected by annexation. It allows for a clearer process, and it allows for an informational meeting so folks can testify about a contested annexation and let that testimony be heard. The administrative law judge has to take that into consideration. We are pleased that there is an expansion of property owner petition annexations, albeit a provision that is sunset in a year, so we hope we will be back at the table in a good faith effort to continue the good discussions we've had with townships and to try to preserve that provision as well as working with them on their other issues that they still have on this issue, and we think that the task force provides a good forum to continue those discussions. I think we've generated a lot of goodwill and trust among the organizations, which is something that's been lacking over the last several years on this issue. And so I think that we are optimistic going into the task force that we can have productive discussions that make this whole process better for everyone.
I did talk with members of the committee. I have talked with Representative Olson that if there were no appropriations and there was no controversy, we would allow this to go on the omnibus bill under the government operations provisions that relate to local governments. And do we have any objection to that? Otherwise, I'll have Mr. Shepherd prepare an amendment for tomorrow, as amended today, that would reflect what this group is talking about. Mr. Shepherd, could you get that ready for tomorrow? I'm not hearing any outrage on the table, so, okay. Any other discussion?
We're saving it for tomorrow, Mr. Chairman.
We'll save the outrage for tomorrow. okay, the Chair already knows motion that House Bill 3925 be recommended to pass and go to the General Register, as amended. Any other discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Bill's passed. Congratulations. Members, we have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Members, we have no more bills for today. We will be meeting tomorrow at 8:15 sharp to mark up the omnibus bill. Please have your amendments to Mr. Shepherd quickly. If you don't have it in by the time we convene tomorrow, we don't know that we're going to get to it because we want to mark it out by 10:15. And I'm going to try to talk with Representative Hilty to see if some of the amendments we can consolidate so we don't have to take so much time.
Statements.
Turned.